my name is Michael McCusker. I seem to be about a minute early, which is okay because I don't have to read as fast all the things I have to say this next half hour's rant. I'd like to give a prologue to it. 45 years ago, Americans rode an eagle to the moon. 10 years later, when gas shortages made it difficult to get home from work, another eagle popped out of a 3-year crypt and declared itself reborn. July 20th, 2014, is the 35th birthday of the revived North Coast Times Eagle, Akka, the born-again bird. 10 years to the day, an American astronaut described the moon as a magnificent desolation. The resurrected paper eagle reawakened into a desolate world of its own. Instead of lifeless, it swarmed with billions of busy, ambitious creatures, though at least half were starving or underfed. Millions more were killing each other, or planned to. A few impoverished the many. The planet was despoiled for short-term profit and pleasure. Truth, as usual, was a first casualty. The North Coast Times Eagle was born again because First Amendment newspapers had become as rare as a nation's symbol, the bald eagle, its first editorial said. The first newspaper published in the American colonies hit the streets of Boston on September 15, 1690, but was soon suppressed because of unkind remarks about the British crown. 45 years later, in 1735, John Peter Zenger was put on trial and acquitted for defamation against the English king in his newspaper, the New York Weekly Journal, which raised issues of a free press that contributed to the First Amendment. 30 more years passed before Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, which inflamed the American Revolution, and later Rights of Man, which was made the rationale of the French Revolution, its 225th anniversary celebrated this past Monday, July 14th, known to the world as Bastille Day. In commemoration of the born-again bird's Renaissance Day, July 20th, I wish to read something I have collaged from several articles I wrote as editor-publisher for nearly 30 years, until digital challenges triggered its third trip to the crypt. And I call it The Temples of Media, and I believe I should probably here give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion in all of the temples of all of the universes. And I start with a quote by Nelson Mandela. A free press is the foundation of liberty. And from George Orwell. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. The Temples of Media. Forgive me for this, but I quote Thomas Jefferson. The basis of our governments being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right, and were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers, or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. He wrote that in a letter to a friend during the time the Constitution was being formed. It has, of course, been quoted to the point of being a cliché, and I culled it from a popular Sunday magazine. A few years later, he would disavow the statement if it was brought up. I quote Jefferson not only because I chanced onto his thought. It is a guiding principle of newspapers and broadcast journalism, as well as its newer digital forms, the so-called media that evermore dominates our lives and society, and in particular defines small, underfunded, and poorly circulated First Amendment publications and limited-range listener-sponsored public radio stations that continue against all evidence and with considerable anxiety to believe that human beings ought, by right of birth, be free and equal, and, if they are not, at the very least, they should be able to think and speak freely without retribution. Everybody claims to love the idea of freedom of thought, speech, and performance, but most feel uncomfortable with freedoms they do not endorse, generally regarding them as sources of moral, economic, or patriotic decline of the nation. What might be described as the independent advocacy media operates in the usual climate of verbal and political civil war between those who would enlarge freedoms of speech, thought, and action, and those who would restrict them. This unfettered media is a hodgepodge of a few small presses and public radio stations, as well as internet blogs obsessed with visions unaffected by commerce. They are descended from radical newspapers and magazines that blossomed briefly a few decades ago, and their lineage threads back to the prickly press that fostered the First Amendment, which denies government or anyone else the right to interfere with freedom of speech. The independent advocacy media has few pretensions toward objectivity and fewer illusions about its probability. Most small independent journals and broadcasters are chronically understaffed, underfunded, and generally misunderstood because they seldom reflect popular opinion. They act, often myopically and insensitively, as consciences and torchbearers, and most are fierce and shrill advocates for large or esoteric causes. They are usually on hard times and fail more often than they are replaced. A common trait among peripheral media is to either revive from a few deaths or succumb forever. Small, impoverished, out-on-the-fringe media generally dwell in local obscurity. They are often in stormy opposition to the bland or autocratic community rule and standards of their circulation areas. The fringe is most normally their habitat. They defy the momentum toward the mega-big as they incubate ideas or ideologies that captivate or hold them captive. Radically inclined, usually malnourished, hogtied by its own paradox, independent media's vows of poverty dovetail with probability and implicitly limit financial contact with ideologically incorrect sources of revenue that spread the diseased creed of consumer consumption through mainstream media. Small potatoes newspapers, radio stations, and probably a few insolvent internet media take their begging bowls out on the street like hungry monks or organize parties with music, poetry, food, and liquids, and pass the hat among fans, sympathizers, and rubberneckers who come through the door. It is this obsession with the principle that all human beings are free and equal that keeps the majority of the poverty press struggling on. In particular, our national freedoms seem to be only wishful lies, bedtime stories told us by those we apparently select to lock our minds in chains to avoid responsibility. Nearly everyone is fearful of the dangerous, uncertain period we are struggling to live through. No one seems to know what to do, and the simplest answers are probably wrong. Fear shows concern and masquerades as apathy. Truth becomes event translated into entertainment. Small, independent media that seldom make money are large on seeking answers and truths. Though never quite satisfyingly pure, truth must yet, in the real world, be free of deceit and distortion. It must be like a rock or a star, a fact defined by its existence. A cornerstone of the American Revolution and its subsequent Constitution was that not only would Americans be independent as a newly formed nation, but that each person was a citizen of a republic, which reflected the concern of the founders that both aristocracy and the masses provoked separate but equal problems. A free and unconstrained press was recognized as essential, and for more than a century, American journalism was robust, if partisan. Until 20th century journalism moved away from political feuding to promoting a corporate industrial status quo under the rubric of objectivity. The press itself became a huge corporate conglomerate of print, radio, television, and internet, now called the media, uppercase. The contrary press was relegated to the fringes and has generally acted as the mouthpiece for radical and esoteric political causes. It is called the alternative media, lowercase. Persistent efforts by government and powerful elites to dominate and manipulate public dialogue, particularly in matters of political dogma and social behavior, have always been dangerous and usually the guise for arbitrary usurpation of the apparatus of communication. Realization of this led directly to the Constitution's First Amendment, which is only 225 years old in 2014. The First Amendment states clearly and simply that neither government nor anybody else has the right to deny or interfere with freedoms of speech, press, or religion, or with public gatherings. It is unequivocal. Nothing shall abridge freedom of speech, therefore freedom of thought. It is our distinguishing ideal, unfortunately more in theory than actuality. Not our wealth or world power, nor our system of acquisition and consumption, is as important as the inspired attempt to reverse history and make it possible for people to be free and independent under laws of their own choice. No one should ever be surprised that a government does not encourage liberty or independent opinion among its subjects. Democracies are elaborate power balances between diverse parties that constantly seek advantage over the others. A most important assumption of a democracy is that the flow of information should not be tampered with nor be restricted if democracy is to survive the incessant tugs of war between its parties. But of course, interfering with and manipulating information is among the highest priorities of political power, which accurately assumes the general populace will not give much thought to mind control efforts most of the time. Stripping First Amendment rights and freedoms is indispensable to undermining democracy, especially its protections of thought and expression. The First Amendment has not prevented attempts to impose religious or political orthodoxy. The excessive repression of the McCarthy era ruined the lives and professions of many of the nation's best writers, artists, and teachers. Christian fundamentalists, in particular, have been attempting to ban books from schools and public libraries for decades, and other censorious groups demand control over the contents of school textbooks and suppression of everything from pornography to Mother Goose. The First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech and a free press in the assumption that liberty survives only in an atmosphere of free and open expression of thought and opinion, no matter how diverse, uncomfortable, obscene, or absurd. Freedom to differ is not limited to things that do not matter much, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun wrote. That would be a mere shadow of freedom. The test of its substance is the right to differ as to things that touch the heart of the existing order. And that was Blackmun. The right to speak implies a responsibility to those who listen. A listener to free speech is free to tune out the speaker, but shutting up the speaker is quite a different matter. The listener is threatening the right of the speaker to speak, which is not his or her right to do, no matter how audacious or offensive. As U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist wrote in a majority opinion regarding the defamation of religious evangelist Jerry Falwell, who was depicted in a Hustler magazine cartoon performing incest with his mother in an outdoor toilet, which tread on several taboos, the First Amendment does not only protect the reasonable, but also the outrageous. Article 1, Section 8 of Oregon's state constitution is even more insistent. No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. Controversy, a dreaded word that is anathema to corporate mega media, is the language of democracy, the robust dialectic of conflicting opinions. It implies debate, argument, even conflict of philosophies. It presumes an idealism born of human aspirations and experience. It demands intelligence beyond self-aggrandizement and simplified pontification. It requires serious rather than superficial or frivolous thought, not the zany, but the petty or trivial, without which political and personal independence dies. Without controversy, there is no dialogue, only obedience to edict and command. The only appropriate response to controversial or unpopular ideas is public rebuttal, not censorship. Yet those who claim to rule in democracy's name, in order to enlarge their own powers, continually attempt to limit the range of ideas and information necessary to engage in the argument of opinion that is indispensable to political and personal freedom. A few thousand low-profile publications constitute the alternative media in the United States, which includes blogs and zines, and perhaps half as many independent listener-sponsored radio stations, such as KMUN-FM here in Astoria, with satellites for Warrenton and Tillamook, and Portland's KBOO. And they operate on the cutting edge of political, environmental, cultural and ideological controversies, providing fresh ideas and insights that mainstream mega media, initially reluctant to jeopardize its profits by espousing change or radical concepts, later trumpet as their own when some of the ideas catch on. Without an independent media, journalism is hardly more than an artfully deceptive method of misleading the public, of providing illusions and deceits to thwart public response to the chicaneries and jingoism of the corporate capitalist class, which regards itself as the country's rightful aristocracy despite the admonition of history. The independent media in the USA and all over the world provides an indispensable forum for the exchange, analysis, synthesis, and arguments that are the basis of any culture or society. Their objectives are, in microcosm, the same as are debated everywhere on earth: to assist in the eradication of inequality, sexism, racism, poverty, and war, and to document the dooms and glooms, the perversities and horrors, rarely the triumphs, of our busy, ill-tempered species. Occasionally, a maverick, limited distribution publication can reach into the heart of the nation. I.F. Stone's Weekly, for example, profoundly influenced a generation opposed to racism and a vicious, corrupt war, and was the archetype for numerous other alternative journals. It is somewhat myopic to suggest that only conventional approaches to issues that critically affect society should be considered. The common ground, which is not represented by the mainstream media despite its claims, is certainly a forum at which extremes meet and see rapprochement, but the more specific audience ought not to be ignored. It is just such esoteric media, left or right, shrill or reasonable, that keep the self-styled mainstream media on a somewhat honest course and not entirely blown about by commercial interests and its own hubris. The mainstream media is no longer a corrective to the corruption and malfeasance of government and its evil axis of wealth and power. It acts as proselytizer, the conduit by which officiality boilerplates its transgressions to the public, and despite a few recent qualms of conscience, has generally acted as a cheering section, or perhaps more accurately, as a militarized propaganda subdivision of plutocratic government. The growth of huge media chains and entertainment networks, both nationally and worldwide, has long made news gathering and reporting hostage to advertising and profit, and concentration of ownership threatens the diversity of independent media. The trend is that mega corporations are increasingly in control of the information we receive, and they influence political and legal decisions about its use and flow, such as the 1985 Oregon Supreme Court ruling that corporations, which are individuals under the law, cannot be investigated and reported about without great risk of libel suit. That ruling, which was against a Portland weekly newspaper and favored a major bank, said essentially that while celebrities of the moment can be inexhaustively exhumed in the media, institutions that affect the lives of millions are virtually sealed off from public scrutiny. Technology, in particular satellites, fiber optics, and computers, has enabled the immense growth of communications conglomerates that are instantaneous and global. Multinational corporations, which might be considered private governments that influence and often dominate public governments, are able to transmit and receive data to and from or subsidiaries everywhere on Earth. They are also able to control and manipulate information pertinent to their activities, which gives them powers unanticipated by the framers of the Constitution, whose concerns were limited to the powers of reigning government. The basic idea of communication in the vast centralized societies of the current era is to profit from the self-interested reflexes of couch potato masses and to stimulate world markets. Rarely are education or egalitarian stimulation given priority or even airtime. A workable definition of information and the purposes it serves is essential. Whether it is a source of public dialogue and crucial to an open society, or if it should be privately controlled to reflect only certain ideas and points of view. A corollary question is if the use and dissemination of information should be treated as a business regulated by a relative few who seek profit from it. A.J. Leibling, who was generally dyspeptic about subordination of information, caustically claimed that a free press existed only for those wealthy enough to own one. The media, in all its hydroid forms, does an inadequate job. It is probably impossible to examine, publish, and broadcast the trillions of bits of data generated every day. There is too much to write about, to televise and report, to think about, to debate and discuss, and it moves too quickly, changes too rapidly to pin down well enough, despite the current 24-hour news cycle. There are as many forms of communication as groups of special interest using them. It would seem that half the stars at night are communication satellites. They have forever changed radio, television, programming, and access, and provide with fiber optics cables, computers, and fax machines, as well as the internet, cell phones, iPods, Blackberries, etc., etc., and etc., instantaneous information worldwide. The proliferation of special interest groups, citizens groups, political action groups, even library boards and soap opera fan clubs that publish newsletters, fanzines, videos, DVDs, tapes, newspapers, ad infinitum, engage in political, religious, or business mass mailings, snail or email, own or syndicate programs on radio, television stations, or networks, or blogs. All of this print and babble saturate us with information, virtually all of it self-promotional, biased, and of questionable veracity. It is this which confounds the believers of information as the temple of freedom. To cull through the immensities of twaddle and drivel to discern what is pertinent, or work through the purposely misleading, might finally be too much to require or expect of a citizen. Suppression, after all, fires the wronged spirit. Gluttony buries it. Public apathy is not accidental or the result of not having access to information. It is most usually the opposite, a premeditated response to a society awash in paper and electronic verbiage. We know too much. Everything moves too swiftly for any of us to remember most of what we receive from various media. By the time anyone starts to discuss a subject heard on radio, seen on television, or read in newspapers or on the internet, so many other things have intervened and besieged attention that will most likely be half forgotten. People who listen to independent radio stations like KMUN wish for more than babble shrieking from the radios, and viewers of public broadcasting search for more than the drivel and schlock beamed to the masses by commercial networks. Yet intimidation by the FCC, the gestating ministry of truth, Orwell predicted would rise to be the temple of the state, suppresses creativity and controversy. Risk-taking essential to creativity and independence shrivels to mumbles of acquiescence. We should remember Orwell. He invented a language, newspeak, which was based on erasing unwanted ideas in the pretense of simplifying the public dialogue. He warned that what is removed from language is forgotten in the individual and collective mind. Orwell was wrong, though, when he suggested that a propaganda system depended upon violent coercion. Instead, in a post-Orwellian world, we suffer the benign control of a powerful system of indoctrination and propaganda that needs little coercion to set an agenda for what people will think about. Policing public morality, claiming, of course, that it is only being reflected, is usually an indecently popular and effective method of intruding control over what we read in our newspapers, listen to on our radios, and view on our televisions, and are ultimately persuaded to accept as truth and reality when in reality our vision has been distorted, our perception atrophied, as are our personal values and liberties. There is no single right or truth, nor is there a single wrong or deceit. Shades fog every issue, denying absolutes, no matter how insistently projected. The real purpose of the press, or media, is little understood, which is as much its own fault as it is from public skepticism and distrust. The people expect event and spectacle which are ardently reported, and the infotainment machine provides instant celebrities and fashions. But the central function of the media is to act as the public conscience and critical watchdog of authority, the cry of alarm when authority is exceeded or corrupt. The media must act as a forum and instrument of public dialogue and debate, presenting differing views, even as U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, "expressions of opinion that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death." Above all, it must be honest and open with its readers, its viewers, and listeners. A free and open flow of information, regardless of ideology or opinion, despite the strenuous job of separating truth from fiction, deceit, gossip, and obscenity, information from disinformation, is quite truthfully the only method of preserving what remains of our freedoms and enlarging them in a turbulent world recoiling from morbid tyrannies that claim to be regimes of the people. The continuity of a culture of so-called radical journalism is essential, which journalism schools seem to be breeding out of recent generations of young journalists in a quest for centrist or objective principles of news and commentary. It is crucial for widely divergent views of everything have public conduits, and the very edgy on-the-fringe media is just about all that persists against the pervasive conformatization of American media and society. The paradox, of course, is that fringe media is readily dismissed as not only being outside of mainstream centrist conformity, but also that it preaches to the fringe and the great masses of Americans, of whom less than half generally vote, seldom read, watch, or listen to heretic or apostate media. Yet the choir must be kept up with trends of music, as medical people the light speed changes in medicine. When what is considered a mainstream source of information becomes increasingly like Goebbels speak, Fox TV News, for example, the fringe media has to pick up the slack of the quickly disintegrating First Amendment. Although it might seem absurd to print newspapers in an era when print media is supposed to be dying as a result of the Internet and amidst a crippling recession depression, it is in such perilous uncertain times that independent, nonprofit, to say the least, publications are most necessary. Printed independent newspapers or magazines, such as Astoria's Hip Fish, must keep popping up because they are not simply fringe agitprop, but are more cogently the recurrent incubation of American journalism. And the more castrated and concentrated the mainstream media becomes, a painful and insipid form of oblivion, the more necessary for small, self-reliant, non-centralized publications and media to flower. It is not only necessary to speak truth to power, but also to egregious consumption and waste, to apathy and avarice. Truth must also speak to conscience, as well as to humanity's penchant for slaughtering itself and despoiling the planet it lives on. William Allen White wrote in a Pulitzer Prize-winning essay, "You say that freedom of utterance is not for times of stress, and I reply with the sad truth that only in times of stress is freedom of utterance in danger. No one questions it in calm days because it is not needed, and the reverse is true also. Only when free utterance is suppressed is it needed, and when it is most needed, it is most vital to justice. This state is in more danger from suppression than from violence. Violence indeed is the child of suppression." That is something I wrote, and I'd like to follow up with the first editorial I wrote, Volume 1, Number 1, July 20th, 1979, in the North Coast Times Eagle, "The Eagle Has Landed." The only corpse successfully revived in recorded history was that of Lazarus, who is said to have lived several years afterward. Jesus Christ is reported to have arisen from the dead, but even the most ardent advocates of his resurrection admit he was only on earth a scanty 40 days, and Jonah was still alive when the whale spit him ashore. Countless other claims of resurrection or rebirth have been made, not the least among them Count Dracula and Richard Nixon. With such inspired precedent, the North Coast Times Eagle is born again. It is born again because First Amendment newspapers have become as rare as the nation's symbol, the bald eagle. The independent press has virtually disappeared, homogenized into the huge corporations that also control the country and probably the world. In this age of the great system's devotion to any principle other than perpetuation of the status quo seems quaint and naive and faintly dangerous. Yet even the most random demographic of this wild and stormy coast would show that loyalty to the metallic demands of the corporate structure is not a prime aspiration of its inhabitants. To the contrary, this rare splinter of sand between mountains and ocean has traditionally served as a refuge for those seeking the fundamental freedoms guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. Men and women of all ages and preoccupations who have immigrated here or who have remained here demand personal control over their own lives. But even that has come into conflict. The enormous pressures of population and economics threaten the way we live. The great contradictions between freedom and property have finally reached us. Like everything else, the role of the press is in question. There should be no doubt. The press should represent no other special interest than the First Amendment. This becomes patently impossible when the press is controlled by the corporations whose interests are often in conflict with the Constitution. Exactly 10 years ago, a space capsule named the Eagle landed on the moon, and for the first time in history, a human being had walked onto a planet other than Earth. It was the most spectacular accomplishment in history. Our expectations since then have more or less followed the course of Skylab, which fell out of the sky. We live in an increasingly nasty time. The petroleum age races to its end. Inflation and recession tumble over each other. The country crawls with greed and corruption. Perhaps the war to end all wars will occur soon. Even the world's weather is grim. Twice out of the egg and once out of the crypt, the reborn North Coast Times Eagle will attempt lighting matches against a darkening wind. And that was my first editorial in my first issue of the reborn North Coast Times Eagle, 20 July, 1979. And for all of its flaws and peculiarities, I think the Times Eagle did attempt lighting matches against the darkness. And this has been Michael McCusker. I might see you next week if certain occurrences do not occur. Until then, happy moon landing day and whatever else you might do in the next week of this July month, one of the two crammed in to honor the Caesars, Julius and Augustus.